We are talking today with George Galloway. George Galloway is the Respect Party's Member of Parliament for Bethnal Green and Bow in London, a seat he won after his expulsion from the Labour Party after 36 years for his opposition to the Iraq War. He is in town speaking along with his new book, Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington, The Brit Who Set Congress Straight About Iraq. George, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
You're welcome.
If I could begin and ask you, what was the motivation in putting together your book?
Well, actually, an American publisher, the New Press, contacted me quite soon after the Senate hearing, which had a pretty big impact, I think, in certain circles here. I got 22,000 emails myself from the United States, 99% of them positive, which is a change for me. I think people felt that I'd got inside the bubble, if you like, in Washington and had told the truth to power, which not many people have had the chance to do. And those who do have the chance, Democratic Party opposition senators and congressmen, frequently really don't do. And there's a lot of unmet need in the United States, I think, for someone to speak up for the kind of views that I expressed. So the New Press contacted me. They asked me to do the book. I did it quickly. And this tour, which you can follow on the web, www.mrgalloweygoestowashington.com, is 10 cities in 12 days. And if the demand is still there, I'll come back.
All right. And a lot of this stems around your long-term opposition to the U.S. and,
yes,
and U.K. policies towards Iraq.
Yes.
I wonder if you can kind of give us a history of that. When did that start?
In fact, this is the second time I've spoken in Seattle. Some years ago, on a speaking tour of Canada, I made a raid south across the border and spoke to some very fine people in Seattle, many of whom I'm still in touch with. In those days, I was speaking out against the sanctions on Iraq, which killed 1 million people, most of them children, most of them dead before they ever got to know they were Iraqis, but died for no other reason. What the Pope, the late Pope, John Paul II, called the slaughter of the innocents, what David Bonnier, the Democratic Party congressman from Michigan, called infanticide masquerading as politics. I was one of the very few people, along with some fine Americans like Kathy Kelly, Voices in the Wilderness, who were trying to alert the world to the catastrophe of Iraq under this embargo, which was killing an Iraqi child every 6 minutes of every day and night of every year for well over a decade. So I just happen to believe that it's immoral to kill other people's children because you've fallen out with their dictator, more especially when you put that dictator into power in the first place and gave him the wherewithal to be stronger and stronger in the first place. And that's the case with the Iraqi dictatorship. When I used to be outside the Iraqi embassy in London demonstrating for human rights and democracy in Iraq, British ministers and businessmen were inside selling him guns and gas, and the same was true here in the United States.
Some of your critics point to a visit that you had made to Iraq in 1994 and things that were said then. I'm wondering if you can give us the history on that.
Yeah, sure. Although, you know, 1994 was a long time ago. I've been elected 3 times to the British Parliament since then, and many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis have been killed since then, and they're all much more important issues than what I may or may not have said in a radio broadcast or a television broadcast 11 years ago. But it's widely quoted by my enemies that I praised the dictator Saddam Hussein, which anyone who knows me knows it must be absurd, because only a few weeks before the 1994 meeting with Saddam Hussein, I described his regime as a bestial dictatorship. I didn't do it in a corner somewhere in a that's uncheckable. I did it on the floor of the House of Commons, which can be consulted by a simple touch of a button on the internet. So I have nothing to apologize for in terms of my long years of opposition to the Iraqi regime. You heard me speak in Seattle. You heard me say then what I said about the Iraqi regime, and I'm saying the same now, and I said the same 25 years before. So these people who are doing the dirty work of the pro-war forces in America, especially if they can use a previous attachment to the left as a cover, are setting out to disrupt the tour and blunt the sales of the book. But it's not working. Everywhere I go, there's seldom short of a 4-figure crowd. It's a bad night if I only get one standing ovation. So I'm clear that there's a very big market in the United States for the perspective that I have, which is the perspective that's held by the great majority of the world. And the United States opinion polls today and yesterday indicate that a clear majority of the people in the United States think the same way. We should be out of Iraq and we should never have been there. That's what the New York Times poll shows, and it's what the poll in USA Today that I read today shows.
So, sticking with 94 just for a second, was that an official visit, and or did you also make visits similar to like what Kathy Kelly would do? She'd go over there kind of see what was going on and to deliver medical supplies.
1994 was the second time I had visited Iraq. I visited it in 93. I didn't visit again between 94 and 98. And then between 98 and 2002, I visited many times. I met Saddam Hussein twice, exactly the same number of times as Donald Rumsfeld met him. The difference being that Mr. Rumsfeld met him to sell him guns and give him maps to target them better, and I met him to try and stop sanctions, suffering in war. But in the times that I was traversing the country, at the same time as Kathy Kelly and other very few heroes at that time, I was crossing the killing fields as she was, I was smelling the death as she was, I was being filled with the same kind of horror with which she was filled, and it was even harder to bear because nobody in the West really wanted to know. I could show you my scars. I spent years with every breath that I could trying to alert people to this disaster, this man-made catastrophe that was taking place. 1 million children, that's a pretty big mass grave, you know. In a country of 21 million, to kill 1 million of their children is a pretty big crime. And that's what the sanctions regime did.
At that time, were people in the UK more aware and more receptive to your stance then?
Not at all. I'm afraid that the reality is that large numbers of Muslims dying in the world doesn't ring many bells in the West. And that's the problem, you see, because the Muslims in the world know very well that it doesn't ring many bells in the West. They know very well that for the West, the blood of some people is more valuable than the blood of others. And it's that double standard which fills them with rage and hatred. And it's that rage and hatred which spawns the kind of terrorism, mass murder of 9/11 or 7/7 in England or the Madrid train bombs. Out of the swamp of that hatred comes these monsters. And it follows that it must be wise politically to try and drain that swamp, to try and reduce that swamp of the bitterness and hatred. And that means stopping the double standards, stopping propping up dictatorships who rule the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other. Stop giving General Ariel Sharon a blank check to repress the Palestinians with. Stop this grotesque bias towards Israel and United States policy. Start to find some even-handedness, some fairness. Try to find within the US policy establishment some sense of what the crime is that's been committed against the Palestinian people, and so on. If we did these things, we would protect ourselves much more effectively against terrorism than merely investing in more and more Patriot Acts and more security forces.
Then we move forward to about 2002, and it was looking like it was pretty clear that the U.S. was going to be going back into Iraq or exponentially increasing the number of attacks in Iraq. What were you doing then?
Well, I had emerged as one of the leaders of the anti-war movement in Britain, which moved millions of people. We had the biggest demonstrations our country had ever seen, to the power of five, in fact. 2 million people on the 15th of February, just before the war. These were unprecedented days. Because, you know, even before they knew what they know now, the British people were by majority against this war. Now that they know what they know now, that it was all a pack of lies that we were being told, then you can hardly find anyone anywhere who'll admit to having formerly believed that the war was a good idea. Sometimes seems that only Mr. Blair is the last man standing in the country who thinks it was the right thing to do. But back then, our politicians were ignoring the views of the majority, clear majority, even before we knew what we know now. So we decided that the anti-war movement needed a political voice. It's important to march, it's necessary to march, but it's not sufficient to march. You need to have a political voice, you need to be able to vote. You see, the members of parliament voted for the war in their hundreds. You can't find any of them now, as I say, who will admit to having done it voluntarily. They all claim that somebody put their arm up their back, which makes you wonder what kind of parliamentarian would be would allow themselves to be so intimidated. But the people outside were against the war, but the people in the parliament, inside the bubble in Westminster, voted for it. And so we set up Respect. Respect is the anti-war coalition in politics. And in the general election 5 months ago, we did fantastically well. Just over a year and 4 months old. We won one seat. We came second in three seats. We came third in another. We came fourth in four seats. And we scored 4 of the 10 biggest swings against the government in the whole country that day. So respectcoalition.org, you can check out our policies there and what we stand for. We think it's a model that could be studied in other countries, including this one. It's not an attempt to create a party as such in the old kind of traditional left-wing mold. It's an attempt to create a coalition of people of sometimes quite divergent views, but who agree on the very most important things.
So was it after you joined the Respect Party that you tried to go to Iraq one more time and bring about a peaceful resolution?
I had my second and final meeting with Saddam Hussein in August of 2002 when I asked to see him, to persuade him to allow the arms inspectors, Dr. Hans Blix and his arms inspectors, back into the country. I had a long meeting with him, an hour and a half, the last 20 or 25 minutes of which was just him and me and two other ministers. I asked him if he would dismiss everyone else because I wanted to talk man-to-man, face-to-face with him. And when I got him alone, more or less alone, I said, listen, I heard everything you said in the previous part of the meeting, but you really must listen to me. You must allow these weapons inspectors back in. You must cooperate with them. You must destroy your weapons of mass destruction. He looked me in the eye. He said, Mr. George, we know everything that you did to try and avoid the disaster that has befallen the Iraqi people. We would not lie to you. We do not have weapons of mass destruction. Now, I'm bound to tell you, my heart sank when he said that, because I thought, he's even lying to me. Even at this 11th hour, he's lying to me, because even I could not believe the scale of the mendacity of the propaganda campaign that had been mounted about the weapons of mass destruction could be completely false. And isn't it come to something when it's the dictator who's telling the truth and the leaders of the free world who are the liars?
So have you had other realizations since then? Was that, in a way, a turning point with just how bad things have gotten in the world?
Well, I think Abu Ghraib was probably the bottom for me. Somebody said, you know, one of the reasons I was expelled from the Labour Party was for calling on British soldiers to disobey illegal orders. I always couldn't really understand the brouhaha over that, because it's a legal obligation on all soldiers not to obey illegal orders since Nuremberg in 1945. But that was actually on my charge sheet for which I was expelled. But somebody asked me in the United States the other day, well, what do you mean by illegal orders? I said this. I'll tell you what would be an illegal order. An order to strip these prisoners naked and pile them on top of each other and make them commit indecent acts against each other and savage them with dogs and attach fake electrodes to their genitals and pretend that you're about to electrocute them and videotape it all so we can all have a laugh about it in the barracks afterwards. That's a set of illegal orders. If they had been disobeyed in Abu Ghraib, then the reputation of the United States would not be in the toilet, which is where it is today in most of the world.
So then let's fast forward to your last, which I believe was your last visit to the
yes.
States, which was just earlier this year. What was your motivation in coming to Washington, D.C.?
Well, I demanded the right to be heard in front of the U.S. Senate, which had traduced my name around the world utterly falsely on the basis of fabrications. That I had somehow profited from all this work that I've done on Iraq over all these years. They didn't ask me a single question. They didn't write to me. They didn't speak to me. They didn't phone me. They knew nothing about me. But they published an attack on me without having had any contact with me at all. So I demanded the right to be heard. And I was heard. I got up close and personal with somebody who started that day as a presidential hopeful I don't think he ended the day as a presidential hopeful, Senator Norman Coleman, and when he comes up for re-election in 2 years' time, I'm coming to get you, Norm. I'm heading for Minnesota to help and do anything I can to help you, the good people of that state, see the back of you. Of course, a state that was once graced by the representation of Senator Paul Wellstone, now disgraced by the representation of Senator Norman Coleman, a latter-day McCarthyite witch hunter. Now, just for the record, maybe I've said this already, I'm doing so many interviews I forget when I said what. Nobody in Iraq ever gave me one thin dime. Never. One thin dime. And the newspapers that claimed that they had given me, not one thin dime, but hundreds of millions of dollars, making me half a billionaire, have had to pay me very large sums of money in costs and damages for the lies that they told about me. $4 million in costs and damages has been awarded to me in the last year and a half from people making these false allegations, and I will not tolerate them. Anyone who makes them will have to face me. If it's in a land where there is a libel law, they'll face me in court. If it's not in a land where there is a libel law worthy of its name, then they'll have to face me toe-to-toe in argument. You can criticize my politics. You can criticize my judgment, my language, my everything. But don't accuse me ever of having done what I did for money, because that would make me the lowest thief. And I haven't done anything for money. I did it because I believed it was right. And by the way, events are vindicating everything that I said and did on Iraq on a daily basis.
One of the things that came up, I believe it was during your Senate hearing, was some documents where a significant part of it was blacked out. And it might have been the people who were actually there ahead of you. There was an oil company that was getting grilled before you actually began to speak. And I'm wondering if you know if any further information has come out on all those companies that were known to be trading with Iraq.
I think it was something like 10,000 companies were trading with Iraq, and a significant number of them were U.S. Companies with the connivance of the U.S. Government. And two key U.S. allies, Turkey and Jordan, were running on the corruption of the breach of U.N. sanctions. Me, I was against the sanctions root and branch. One of the senators in the hearing invited me to be troubled about the fact that some of these companies were paying kickbacks to the Iraqi regime, allegedly. I told him what troubled me was the death of 1 million Iraqis. I opposed the oil for food program, root and branch, so I'm no more troubled by one part of it than I am by another. It was an utterly immoral policy, which depended upon slaughtering innocent people in order to bring pressure to bear on their dictatorship. And I just morally reject that. I don't think that any justification for that can be mustered. It would have been far more honourable, in fact, to invade Iraq and conquer it than to slaughter its children from an office in New York where men in suits, barbarians in suits, as I called them, make decisions which lead to the deaths of children that they never have to look at, never have to see being planted in the ground. Kathy Kelly and me and others, we saw these children being planted in the ground. And everything looks different once you've seen that.
Do you think that the amount of corporate control and influence on policies has gotten worse in the time that you've been serving?
Definitely, especially in the United States. You need to raise $1 billion to win the presidency of the United States now. To raise $1 billion, you have to fit yourself into a straitjacket that's designed by those who give you the $1 billion. That means you have to follow a certain set of domestic and increasingly also foreign policy demands, or you don't get the money, and if you don't get the money, you can't get elected. And the corrupt nexus which exists between big business and policy in the United States and the military-industrial complex and many other parts of the U.S. corporate life, as we say in Europe, with you get McDonald's, but you also get McDonnell Douglas. And this nexus is one through which very little good passes. And I think it's one of the main problems that you have. It's one of the reasons why you don't effectively have an opposition party in the United States. You have Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and you couldn't slip sixpence between the two parties on the great issues of the day, even though there are millions of people in the United States who want and require something different from that, something better than that.
Do you have a similar problem, or are things heading in a similar direction in the UK?
Well, to some extent, but we have certain protections in Britain that you don't have, just as you have some protections in constitutions and Bill of Rights and so on that we don't have. But on this issue, for example, money doesn't play a very big part in British elections. There are very severe spending restrictions on political campaigning and elections. For example, you're not allowed to buy advertising time on television in Great Britain, and that certainly cuts the cost of elections quite a bit. There's a very severe limit on the amount you can spend in any constituency election, and indeed on your nationwide election, which means that money doesn't play anything like as big a part. But in Labour, for example, my former party, where once it would have been funded by hundreds of thousands of individual members and the support of labour unions who were directly affiliated to the party and who had the right to expect the party would keep them in mind when it came to governing and the interests of their members in mind. That's all gone now. The unions are powerless in the Labour Party today, and the members, as I said, have disappeared in their hundreds of thousands, voting with their feet against New Labour. So they're turning more and more to business people. It's nothing like your skill, but it's nonetheless alarming. And one of the things which happens is that sometimes the millionaires, or billionaires more correctly, who now fund the Labour Party, end up in the government. And that's something new for us. Lord Sainsbury, the owner of a big chain of supermarkets, gives the Labour Party millions of pounds a year. And hey, he's had a seat in the government every year since Mr. Blair was elected in 1997. The Formula One motor racing magnate, Mr. Bernie Ecclestone, gave New Labour £1 million, and hey, New Labour, you turned on the issue of tobacco advertising being banned around the perimeter of Formula One motor racing. So it is a problem in Britain. It is growing, but it isn't remotely on your scale.
Do you think your politicians are a little more honest than ours here?
Well, Britain historically has been an honest polity in the sense that European levels of corruption in government have never been seen. It's one of the things that we were proud of, like the Beatles and the BBC and the footballer Bobby Charlton. This kind of relatively clean politics was something that we were proud of. But I'm afraid the Beatles are gone, the BBC is not what it was, and neither is our reputation for honest government. In that sense, I suppose Britain is becoming a bit less special. We used to be one of the few countries where policemen didn't have guns, and now they have guns and they end up shooting innocent people down on the floor of underground trains, putting 7 or 8 bullets through their heads, as recently happened in the bombing incidents in London. Our ministers never used to be corrupt, but now they govern in the interests of the corporations, and when they leave government, it's a kind of revolving door. They leave government and, hey, they're in the boardroom of the very corporations they used to be working with. So Britain's not the country it was. Most British people regret that. And in foreign policy terms, there's a very deep sense of indignation amongst British people at the way in which Mr. Blair has made us the tail of the American dog. Nobody likes to be a tail. It's not a very nice place to be. And there's a sort of indignity, a feeling of indignity amongst most British people that our country has been reduced to what the Wall Street Journal described Mr. Blair as the best ambassador the United States has ever had. Well, you know, an ambassador is someone sent abroad to lie for his country, as a famous English thinker once said. It's one thing to be sent abroad to lie for your country. It's something else to be sent abroad to lie for somebody else's country.
So moving back to Iraq, what do you see as the solution? What needs to be done?
Well, the only thing the Iraqi people need from us now, from the British and American governments, is the sight of the back of our heads getting on an airplane and leaving their country. That's a necessary precondition for any solution to the crisis that now exists in Iraq, which we have created. It will not be a sufficient condition. I'm not saying that if the British and American forces withdraw that peace and harmony and justice will break out in Iraq overnight. But I am saying that whilst there will still be blood and chaos in Iraq if we leave, there will always be blood and chaos in Iraq if we don't leave. And some of the blood, much of it, more and more of it, will be our own blood. And so for both these reasons, both because we don't want to see any more young American and British boys killed. 8 young Americans were killed in the last 24 hours in 3 different attacks. And that can only escalate, believe me. I know the Iraqis very well. The Iraqi people will fight the occupiers with their teeth if necessary. They will never surrender. They will fight until the British and American armies leave. So it's better that they leave sooner rather than later, unless we want to end up talking about this 10 years from now as a kind of rerun of Vietnam. So we must leave. The Iraqis are capable of agreeing amongst themselves eventually how their country is going to be run. If we don't withdraw, we're going to see a Yugoslav-type civil war in Iraq on top of the world's biggest oil field. And if you're worried about oil at $70 a barrel now, you will not be able to buy a barrel of oil at any price if a Yugoslav war breaks out on top of the world's biggest oil field, believe me.
All right, and then moving to the bigger picture, what do you see as the solution? Where do we need to go to fix our world's woes?
Well, the world's ill-divided, and those that work the hardest are the least provided, as a Scottish folk singer once wrote. And that's the fundamental problem in the world, double standards and injustice. The rich countries are rich because their policies keep the poor world poor, just as rich people in our countries are rich because the poor are poor. And that's a solution, that's a situation that cannot be allowed to go on, unless we want to these waters of hatred to overcome us and sweep us away. The United States has 4% of the population of the world, but it burns 25% of the world's energy. It's 4% of the population of the world, but it consumes 30% of the world's wealth. And the British population is not far behind proportionately. Our parents, some of them, sue McDonald's for making their children obese, whilst 49% of the children of Asia live in absolute poverty. Which means, the definition of which is, that they literally don't know if they will have food tomorrow or not. We can't go on swimming in champagne in the West whilst a quarter of the world, 25%, 1 in 4 of the whole world, does not have access to clean water. That is to say, water that will not make them sick if they drink it. And even that water often has to be walked miles to collect. This injustice, this ill division of the world's wealth, is the fundamental problem. And then when you add the impulse of the rich and powerful countries to dominate the others, to occupy them. The United States now occupies 5 countries in the Arabian Gulf. And those 5 countries, coincidentally maybe, have 550 years of oil and gas under their shores. You don't have to be Einstein to work out why the United States would want to occupy those 5 countries. And these are the kind of things which are fueling the hatred against us. You know, I'm in favor of buying a fly swat if I'm sitting by a swamp. I want to defend myself as best as I can from the mosquitoes emerging out of it. But I'm not a fool. I know that no amount of fly swats is going to protect me from all the mosquitoes that are germinating in that swamp. The only way to get rid of the mosquitoes is to drain the swamp.
All right. I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
You're welcome. Thanks.
We have just been talking with George Galloway. He is in town, part of a speaking tour tied to his new book, Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington, The Brit Who Set Congress Straight About Iraq.